Welcome to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, today we are focusing for the full hour on voting. This 4th of July weekend, Americans will celebrate our country's birthday and the rights and freedoms most of us take for granted, including the right to vote. Now, later on in the show, we'll look at a way to vote gaining in popularity, voting by mail. More than 2.5 million Florida voters have already signed up to vote through the mail, this time even though the general election is still 5 months away.
Yeah, let's begin the program, though, with what could be an enormous change in who may be able to vote here. Hundreds of thousands of Floridians who have not voted in years have been hoping to register and vote in the upcoming August primary and November election. Amendment 4 restored voting rights to most felons in Florida. A federal judge ruled in May that the state cannot require felons to pay outstanding fines and fees before registering to vote. But this week, a U.S. appeals court agreed to hear the case and stop the lower court's ruling from taking effect.
The Brennan Center for Justice is among the groups who fought the state's implementation efforts of that amendment. Sean Morales Doyle is a lawyer for the Brennan Center who focuses on voting rights. Sean Morales Doyle, good to be with you. Thanks for joining the Florida Roundup.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
This decision is a real setback for your organization and everyone who fought to expand voting rights in the state for former felons. What are your thoughts about this ruling?
Well, I guess my first thought is that it's only a stay. It's a temporary decision. So the court hasn't overturned the district court's decision here. It has simply suspended it while the court considers the state's appeal. But yes, it is disappointing that the decision will be stayed. We thought it was and think it is a very good decision. And the reality is that no matter who wins or loses in this case, the without the court's decision in place, it's quite clear that Florida is not capable of administering this law. And that the result will be that there'll be a lot of people who are confused about whether they're eligible to vote and, frankly, unable to even figure out whether they're eligible to vote in the meantime. So we're eager to get to the final resolution.
Right. The July 20th registration deadline for people to get registered to vote is fast drawing near. The primary is August 18th. But the court has set a hearing date of August 11th. So that's past the registration deadline. If you fall into this bucket of someone in Florida with a prior felony conviction, we're talking nearly a million people. They don't know whether they should register to vote or not now, right?
Yes. I mean, there are some of those million who are sure that they don't owe any amount of money and that they can go and register and vote. But I think for a very large number of people, they're going to have a really hard time knowing what they can do. The fact is that even if the law were clear and the rules were clear, it's just really hard to figure out whether you owe money in Florida and how much you owe. So, and that was a big part of why the district court ruled the way it did.
Yeah, I mean, the whole ruling that came down from Judge Hinkle was that the notion that you had to pay fines and fees to vote amounted to a poll tax and that was unconstitutional. Now, the 11th Circuit issuing this stay has granted the governor's request for a rare review of this decision. Can you explain why this is rare that we're seeing this play out in this manner?
Yeah, it's a little bit of inside baseball, I guess, but the normal appeal to a federal appellate court is heard by a three-judge panel. There are 12 active judges in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, but only three of them would hear any given appeal. Occasionally, a party that is dissatisfied with a three-judge decision will ask for the entire 12-judge court to rehear a case. That happens now and again. What makes this particularly rare is that this isn't a rehearing of a three-judge panel's decision. This is the initial hearing. The state appealed and asked for it to go immediately to the full 12-judge court. That doesn't happen very often. I think, I can't speculate as to why the court decided to go that way, but this case is unique in a number of ways. There was an earlier three-judge panel decision in the case back in February, and we have the accelerated timeline we're heading towards an election, not just the August election, but the November election, obviously. And so I'm sure those factors were involved in the court's decision to take this case.
We need to note as well that the appointments President Trump has made to the judiciary have made a difference. He has made Republican-appointed judges the majority in the 11th Circuit. They had been majority Democratic-appointed before 2017. So these are Trump appointees that have weighed in on this.
Yes, they are. I mean, I don't think that... I think people often assume that judges rule in a way that lines up with the politics of the president that appointed them, and we should be careful not to assume that because it's not always the case. And I certainly hope that any judge ruling on this case and expect that any judge ruling on this case will not rule based on their views about how people who are being disenfranchised will vote if given that opportunity, but rather on what the U.S. Constitution says and what it means.
Well, sure. I mean, that's how it's supposed to work. But in our partisan era, certainly cynical political observers see the judiciary as another partisan battleground, and that this is one high profile example of that in this battle for who's going to get to vote in Florida in November in our closely watched swing state. What about that?
I do think that this battle has in some ways become partisan, and that is regrettable. I think rather than looking to the courts for that, I think the reality is that when Florida's legislature and governor acted to put this law into place, it seems that they were likely motivated by things other than what the U.S. Constitution requires and other than what Florida voters decided when they voted for Amendment 4 in 2018. And that is not the way these decisions should be made. And it is unfortunate because I think one of the things that was so amazing about Amendment 4 was the fact that it passed with such broad bipartisan support by Florida's voters. It wasn't a partisan action. It was the action of the people of Florida saying how they wanted their own democracy to look.
Well, your organization and others have urged the court to rule swiftly on this, but we don't know a timetable yet, do we, on how this could eventually play out?
No, I mean, you mentioned earlier that there's a hearing set for August 11th. I think actually the court's decision to take this case en banc means that we don't know that a hearing is happening on August 11th. We don't yet know the calendar. The court will... it has said it will give us a calendar soon. But I think given that that was the expectation before this decision, we are unlikely to have a ruling in the appeal before the August 18th primary in Florida. But I think the expectation is still that we'll have a decision in time for the November election. We think it's important that a ruling come sooner rather than later so that voters in Florida and elections officials in Florida know what the rules are in time for the November election.
If the court rules before the November election, could it then be appealed to the nation's highest court?
It could, yes. I mean, whichever party is on the losing end there could ask for the Supreme Court to hear the case. And there are, ways that the case could end up there. But it's always impossible to know whether that will happen, given the fact that the Supreme Court doesn't have to take every case appealed to it, and that the timetable might be pretty tight.
It might not make it, but it might. You never know. And this is a cohort of voters in Florida that could be a critical demographic in the November 2020 election. And I want to thank you so much for your insights, Sean Morales Doyle with the Brennan Center. Thanks for being with us here on the Florida Roundup. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Desmond Mead is the executive director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. He helped lead the fight against the state's implementation of Amendment 4. Desmond, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. What's your reaction to the U.S. Appeals Court decision to hear the case, and perhaps most importantly to you personally, to stop that earlier court order from taking effect?
You know, when I heard it, my mind just went to, you know, the fact that, you know, this August, I'm going to be actually voting for the very first time in over 30 years. And I think about how many other returning citizens are throughout the state of Florida that's been looking forward to participating in these elections and now are being denied that opportunity because of the stay. And it frustrates me. And what exasperates my frustration is the fact that we have a governor who also has the power to grant clemency and restore people's rights. And when you look at what's been going on throughout this entire year, this governor has yet to have one clemency hearing, right? And so not only are people being shut out right now because of the stay, but the governor is also preventing people from participating in our democracy by not even holding clemency hearings and allowing people an opportunity to get their civil rights restored.
In an earlier case, a three-judge panel of the same appeals court ruled that the implementation of Amendment 4 was unconstitutional and that requiring felons to pay fines and fees to regain the right to vote violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The state had argued that felons have other avenues to petition a court to convert fines and fees to community service or go through that clemency process that you just referenced. Why are those not sufficient?
Well, first and foremost, let's start with the clemency process. There haven't been any. The governor has suspended all clemency hearings for the year. And so there have been zero cases heard by the governor. So that process is not even available. And that is what adds to the frustration.
And how about the petitioning courts to convert fines and fees to community service or working with lending services to forgive debts?
Florida Rights Restoration Coalition has always been committed to operating under the color of law and seek any avenues available to assist people who want to be able to vote to be able to do so. And so we have in the past been utilizing the court systems that's been provided through 7066, as well as we've established a fines and fees fund that we have raised over $500,000, and we have been using those funds exclusively to help people with outstanding fines and fees satisfy their financial obligations so they can register to vote. We will continue to do so. We were hopeful when the lower courts issued their ruling that we wouldn't have to do it anymore. And so this stay that was just issued by the 11th Circuit now forces us to go back to the old system that we were using prior to the lower court's ruling.
The 7066 reference is the Florida legislative bill number for the implementation of Amendment 4 that the legislature passed in 2019, which is the subject of this court fight. Let me ask Desmond about the timing of this. The appeals court hearing is August 11th, which is about 3 weeks after the deadline to register to vote for the August primary here in Florida. What will you do personally? You spoke in the present tense earlier in this conversation talking about voting in August. I take it you're already registered?
I am already registered, and there are countless other returning citizens who are registered and many more who are eligible to register to vote but are not registered yet. And so we will continue to engage. I think there's a deadline of July 20th in order for a person to participate in the August primaries. And so we're going to do everything within our power to identify those individuals who are qualified to register to vote right now, and even those that may have some minimal financial obligations, that we're going to put forth our best efforts to locate them and help them pay off their fines and fees so they can also register before the July 20th deadline.
So it sounds like, Desmond, for those felons who have substantial fines or fees, perhaps the guidance is don't expect to register to vote for the August primary?
For those that have substantial fines and fees, there's still an opportunity depending in which judicial circuit they live. Prior to the ruling, if you can remember, we were able to have agreements within judicial circuits in Palm Beach County, in Dade County, in Hillsborough County, in which we were allowed to have these people with outstanding legal financial obligations actually go through the court system in order for a judge to waive their fines and fees, right?
This was at the state court level, correct?
This was at the state court level, and so we can continue to do so. But unfortunately, we do not have those type of agreements in all of the judicial circuits. But in those that we do, if people are living in those counties, our priority would be to process them through the court system as quickly as possible.
How does a felon who has completed their prison time discover what fines and fees they may owe?
Well, it's very easy, right? And we know that the state is still struggling to put that system together. But one of the easiest things that I can tell anyone is if they contact the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, there is actually a section on our front page that they can actually apply to our fines and fees program. And we have staff and pro bono attorneys that stand at the ready to assist folks in determining exactly what it is that they owe. And once that determination is made, we can help them pay off those legal financial obligations.
Desmond, about how many folks have you registered to vote? Do you expect to register to vote before the August primary?
You know, it's really hard to speculate. Just based on testimony from the Division of Elections during the trial, that we know that there was approximately at that time 85,000 returning citizens that had registered to vote. My organization personally, we've registered over 20,000 returning citizens. And there's an additional 20,000 returning citizens that have at least started the application process through our website.
Are you concerned at all about your ability to vote in August?
I'm not concerned about my ability to vote because any and all financial obligations that I may have incurred have been satisfied. What my heart goes out to are the many individuals who may not cannot afford to pay their financial obligations, but who want to participate in an election, want to be a part of democracy again. And so my heart hurts for them because we had a pathway there, but this day have temporarily blocked them from utilizing that pathway. And they have no choice but to either pay their fines and fees, get a court to waive those fines and fees, or wait for the 11th Circuit to issue a ruling. And God knows when that's going to be.
Desmond Mead is the executive director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Desmond, nice to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Now, still to come on our program today, the big jump expected in voting in Florida through the mail.
We budgeted for an 80% turnout by vote by mail.
There are many considerations that voters are not aware of the first time they're voting by mail.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Convenience and COVID-19 are expected to mean a big increase in Floridians voting by mail in this year's elections. Already, more than 2.6 million registered voters have requested mail-in ballots for the November general election.
Let's talk about it with Bill Cowles. He's the supervisor of elections in Orange County. Bill Cowles, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us here on the Florida Roundup.
My pleasure.
So the I-4 corridor in November is going to be a very closely watched part of the country as ballots come in. Let's talk about what a vote by mail will look like in your county, Orange County. Vote by mail is very popular among Florida voters of both parties. How are you handling that aspect of the elections this year?
Well, as we put together our budget for the November election and knowing the concern across the country about getting out to their polling place, we budgeted for an 80% turnout by vote by mail. So that, what that means is we have enough supplies and envelopes and all that if the numbers grow to that level, we'll be able to accommodate it.
How many people do you have registered right now, and what kind of surge are you expecting?
We are currently just a little over 820,000 registered voters, but when we built our budget, we built the budget anticipating that we could be as high as 900,000 registered voters by November 3rd.
Wow, so nearly a million. And are you doing a campaign in the Orlando area to encourage people to request an absentee ballot or to vote by mail?
Yeah, we've been doing multiple things. We've already sent a postcard out reminding the individuals who have previously voted by mail, but their two-year time had expired and it was time for them to renew, so we've done that. Every new voter who gets a voter information card is getting a message on there about the opportunity to vote by mail. We went through our database and we're about ready to send out close to 200,000 emails to voters who don't have a vote-by-mail request, reminding them to do it. So we're targeting voters in different methods versus doing a one countywide mailing of a vote-by-mail form.
Makes sense. At the same time, let me ask you about this. A report from the ACLU of Florida found that Orange County, your county, had the highest percent of rejected vote-by-mail ballots in 2016. What drove those rejection rates?
Well, unfortunately, the ACLU and Dr. Daniel Smith, the author, clumped in to those totals all of the ballots that were returned undeliverable by the post office into that total. And once you subtract the undeliverables out of there, then it drops us back down into the normal range with other like-sized counties.
So what types of things like that, what types of mistakes or glitches can result in a vote-by-mail ballot not getting counted?
Well, in this case, the voter never got their ballot because it was returned undeliverable, and then we handle those based on the individual situation. A voter can always request another ballot to be mailed to them if they didn't get the first one as they expected. But these were based on postal issues, and there is a category for undeliverable ballots in the statewide system. And unfortunately, in 2016, those numbers were merged in with the other ballots that did not get counted for other reasons.
And what are some of those other reasons? Because one thing we're trying to focus on in this program is get people accurate information about whether the elections will be secure. There has been anxiety about that across the state. Will the elections be secure? Will the votes all get counted? Those perennial Florida questions, you know?
Well, I think the simple answer to it is, first off, the voter should be responsible for their ballot. And so from that standpoint, don't give it to somebody they don't know to turn it in for them. In Orange County, we provide the return postage on the envelope so that the voter does not have to go and seek out postage for returning their ballot. And then on the other part is every county in Florida has a tracking system on the their websites where a voter can go and first see the date of their request, the date their ballot was mailed, the date the ballot is returned to us, what the status is of their ballot, whether there's an issue such as they forgot to sign it or whether it was determined that their signature does not match. And under the court order since 16 and 18, we now have the cure process in Florida where a voter is then immediately notified and they're then given an affidavit that can fix that ballot so it can be counted. And in 2019, the legislature even extended it that they have up until 2 days after the election to get the affidavit in. So if they pay attention to tracking it, they pay attention if they get an affidavit reminding them that they need to fix their ballot. And the other good news is the legislature made the affidavit such that that signature on the affidavit then becomes their official record for their signature for future use. So I think Florida has taken and made some changes that will help as we go forward for voters to feel good that their ballot can be counted. But on top of that, the key thing in Florida, vote by mail is all by paper, and papers can't be hacked.
That's right. What's your reaction as a local supervisor of elections to recent tweets by the president raising doubt about the validity of vote by mail, saying that people will try to vote illegally, that it's somehow rigged?
Well, again, I think, we have to, as administrators, separate the politics and do the voter education with the voters, and that's what interviews like this are doing, is to help educate the voter to understand what truly happens with their ballot.
What is the most common question you are getting from Orange County, Florida voters right now about this election? What's the most important piece of information you're trying to get out there?
Well, I think the most important one right now is about their vote by mail. How do they get one? Did my request expire? How do I renew it? So that's probably number one on it. But then the next one is, are we going to be able to go vote in person? And I think that's because Florida is now into phase two of reopening the state. And as recent evidence has shown, people want to get out. And so I'm anticipating that we're going to have that balance of those who want the security of voting by at home, but also there's those who just want to physically get out and vote in person. And we'll offer all three methods, vote by mail, early voting, and election day.
Last question. What keeps you up at night as you prepare for the primary and the November election?
Well, I mean, obviously right now is, you know, Florida was on the downside in terms of new cases and of the virus. And now we're seeing that there's more, but we're being told that that's not necessarily the case of an upswing, but what happens if there's suddenly a swing and they have to reevaluate our plans? Do we have enough of this? Do we have enough of that? Can we get our hands on enough of this and enough of that to be totally prepared to meet whatever the challenge is on election day for this election?
Bill Cowles, Orange County Supervisor of Elections. At least you've got some time to do all that. And I want to thank you for appearing on the Florida Roundup here with us.
My pleasure. Let's go out and vote.
The process of voting by mail is different than showing up at your polling station during early voting or election day. Daniel Smith is the chairman of the Political Science Department at the University of Florida. Professor Smith, thanks for your time today here on the Florida Roundup. This month, the Florida Secretary of State, Laura Lee, said that Florida is, quote, very well situated to have a secure and effective vote-by-mail process. Do you agree with that statement?
Well, I think we should take that with a grain of salt at this point. We certainly were not prepared in the presidential primary election for this. Indeed, Secretary of State Lee said that voters should request their absentee ballots on the last day that they were permitted to do so. So there was very little forewarning to voters in the start of COVID. Now we're in the midst of this pandemic. Surely we will see at least a 50% increase, if not more, in terms of voters wanting to vote by mail. And I'm really concerned about the capacity of many of the supervisors of elections to be able to deliver ballots to voters and to be able to process those votes.
Earlier in this program, we heard some concerns voiced about even the ability of the Postal Service to deal with the higher volume of vote-by-mail ballots. Do your concerns extend to the Postal Service?
Well, absolutely. We've seen a systematic defunding of the U.S. Postal Service over the last couple decades. The Postal Service has not been immune to its own problems with respect to its staffing, people being out because of COVID and reduced capacity. This Postal Service itself says that it should take about 7 days to get a ballot out, and supervisors themselves say you should expect about 7 days. So if supervisors are mailing their vote by mail ballots out and it takes 7 days and a voter requested it 10 days before, good luck getting that ballot back by Election Day, 7 p.m., which is the current state deadline. So the capacity of the Postal Service has been greatly reduced in many rural areas, or even moderate-sized counties like Alachua County, where there's no longer a U.S. Postal distribution center. Ballots that only have to travel half a mile to get to a supervisor of elections office actually have to travel all the way to Duval County to be processed in Jacksonville before coming back to Alachua County. And so we see that this is, you know, within just normal times, the increased problems with the U.S. Postal Service, those will be exacerbated when we see millions of ballots, millions more ballots coming in both the August and the November general elections.
And you think, again, half as many more ballots will be cast by mail?
Well, if we look at the 2016 versus the 2020 presidential primary, we saw an increase of 50% of all ballots that were mail ballots.
Is that nationwide?
So that was in Florida alone, but we're seeing even higher increases in other states. So Wisconsin, which primary happened after our March 17th presidential primary, upwards of 70% of ballots cast were mail ballots. We saw that in Georgia, a massive increase. And I see no reason why we wouldn't expect the same with voters in Florida in both the August and the November elections, putting their health concerns ahead of their civic duties. We shouldn't have to have that trade-off, but it's a reality right now.
You've found, Professor, that vote-by-mail ballots are more likely to be rejected than those cast in person. So if the projection of more and more people voting by mail for public health concerns, what does that tell you about the potential of rejection of those ballots?
Right. I suspect we are going to see an increase in those rejected ballots as well, because we will be introducing more and more voters into a system that they are not familiar with. Vote by mail is a different way of voting than voting in person. There are many considerations that voters are not aware of the first time they're voting by mail. Most predominantly is their signature. When you're voting in person, your signature needs to match the signature that's on your ID that you're requested to show. When you vote by mail, your signature may or may not look like your signature in your wallet that you would use when you vote in person. It actually has to match what's on record. And that might be a signature that you wrote when you were 17 years old and were pre-registering in high school, and your signature now has changed. It might be something that you used on your first time you registered at the DMV, and your signature has now changed. You may have changed your name and not updated your signature. So there's a different process. And I can tell you that from the research that I've done, first-time vote-by-mail voters, controlling for everything else, are much more likely to have their vote-by-mail ballot rejected than those who are routine vote-by-mail voters.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. The vote-by-mail signature verification process in Broward County, for instance, in 2018, which has come under significant scrutiny because of how difficult it was for the initial count and then the recount for many races in Broward County. But that signature verification process in Broward County, taken as an example here in Florida, is done by visually comparing electronic signatures. Should this be changed?
It's a huge problem. When you have signatures, even at the DMV, which are written on a scratch pad, which are then compressed with 300 DPI and electronically transmitted to a supervisor of election, who then has those compressed images to then compare with an actual signature on the back of an envelope. There is all kinds of possibility in this, at best, art form of comparing signatures that could lead to a voter being disenfranchised.
Well, let me ask it this way then, Professor. How important is that signature protect against fraud when it comes to vote by mail?
So that's an obvious concern. That's why we have IDs that are required when we vote in person to verify the identity of an individual. And that's why it's really important that we have an opportunity for voters to be able to cure their signature if indeed it's missing or it is mismatched in the eyes of a supervisor of elections or a canvassing board. That process has now allowed voters 2 days after Election Day, if they are indeed notified in time, to be able to provide a cure affidavit form. The question is, why wouldn't we allow a greater period?
How does one, in advance of the August primary, see the signature that's on file currently?
Well, you could go in and request that at a supervisor of elections office, or you could submit a new signature through your voter registration update. But there is no way that I know of being able to visually see your signature that's on file, except if you went in person.
If a voter requested a vote by a mail ballot and is listening to this, and now they're concerned about that signature match, and they instead decide to show up at a polling place, a proper polling place, either during early voting or on election day, can they vote at that polling place even if they requested a vote by mail ballot?
Yes, and I would add that this includes people who requested vote-by-mail ballots that never received their vote-by-mail ballot. And we're talking about tens of thousands of people who routinely are not receiving their ballot because they moved and these ballots are not forwardable. In that case, you may come during the early voting period or on election day to your polling location with or without your vote-by-mail ballot, have it canceled on the spot, and be able to vote a regular ballot. So voters need to have that fail-safe of early voting as well as election day voting, because tens of thousands of voters will not receive their vote-by-mail. And I would imagine that we're talking about 100,000 or more will not be receiving their ballots when they request them because they are not forwardable and people have not updated their voter registration address.
University of Florida political science professor Daniel Smith. Now, he says he plans on voting in person in August and November, and he has volunteered to be a poll worker.
Well, still to come on the show, election security. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. And today, for the full hour, we're talking about voting. All of you out there in Florida, the voters, will go to the polls in August and November. The security of the vote has been a concern ever since it was disclosed Russian hackers broke into the election system of two Florida counties in 2016. No vote counts were affected, we were told. And this election year, there are public health worries about voting from the pandemic. Craig Latimer is the election supervisor in Hillsborough County, and he's also the president of the statewide Florida Supervisors of Elections. Craig Latimer, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us here on the Florida Roundup.
It's a pleasure.
What are some of the concerns supervisors of elections around the state are relaying to you about how these elections are going to go?
We're used to contingencies and dealing with issues. I mean, you got to remember, we live in a state that regularly has hurricanes. So there's a lot of planning that goes in place. We do know that in-person voting is probably going to be slower. There's going to be social distancing. There's going to be, you know, not a whole bunch of people in a polling site at the same time to try and practice those guidelines that the CDC has put out there.
Yeah, certainly in this time of pandemic, there is so much more interest in voting by mail, being safe. Now, back in April, your predecessor in the role of leading Florida supervisors, she sent a letter to the governor asking for him to make a number of accommodations at precincts around the state to deal with possibly a shortage of poll workers and other issues they're concerned about. Allowing counties different parameters for early voting, for example, and looking at the number of polling places per precinct, allowing more latitude about vote-by-mail ballots, when those can get in and how things will be tabulated. Have you heard from the governor any response to those requests that came into him from your organization?
Yes, about a week or so ago, a week or 10 days ago, the governor did issue an executive order. One thing it did was allowed state workers to take administrative leave if they wanted to work in a polling site. It also gave us several additional days to process vote-by-mail ballots because we did anticipate an increase in that, and suggested that we might want to get with our school superintendent to see about closing the schools down so that we'd have schools as polling sites.
And how confident are you that those changes will help things go smoothly at the polls in Florida? Other primaries around the country we've seen happen in recent weeks have been chaotic, difficult to pull off. How do you see things going in Florida by comparison?
I think we're going to be fine. Like I said, we're going to have a slower process for in-person voting at both early vote and election day. I can tell you that I have not had any state workers contact me to become a poll worker. And in my particular county, the school superintendent is unable to adjust the calendar to accommodate voting at school sites.
Are you worried about a shortage of poll workers, either in the primary or the general?
I'm not at this point, no. We've got our poll workers ready to go. They've told us that they're going to, you know, be there. So we're going to continue to recruit some more poll workers so that we've got a little backup there. And I think that's what all the counties are doing.
In 2016, of course, we learned that Russian operatives tried to hack into multiple Florida counties' election software and meddle with the process in Florida. We still don't know the details of what happened in 2016 here. What message do you have for the voters out there that this election will be secure? Because there is some concern about that.
This is the biggest thing that any voter in Florida needs to know, and this is state law, and we all operate the same way. The servers that house our tabulation systems are a standalone air gap system. They're not connected to the voter registration system. They're not connected to anything. Plus, in Florida, before every election, we do what's called a logic and accuracy test, where we test the equipment that it can read every single space on the ballot where a vote can be cast, and the accuracy. Then after the election, there's an audit process that takes place. Your canvassing board can randomly select a race and precincts, and then you go find all the ballots, early vote, vote by mail on election day, and you hand count those ballots to, again, ensure that your tabulation equipment counted correctly. Or you can use an electronic audit system.
If those were the really good protocols that were in place 4 years ago, then how did Russian hackers break through in at least two Florida counties? We still don't know which ones.
And I don't know which ones either. As I said, though, the tabulation equipment server is not connected to the registration. You know, we have a statewide voter registration system. Each county feeds into that. And there's all kinds of backups of this information, too. Since that time, you know, the state embarked on a joint election security initiative, JESSI, J-E-S-I, and there was grant funds that came down to allow supervisors to enhance security on their systems. All 67 supervisors have taken advantage of that.
And we did. Florida did get federal money to shore up our election security. Do you think the state should put any more funds toward this effort?
I think it's a case-by-case basis. You know, and I know that this last round of money, the state tried to, and we were encouraging the state to do it, to enhance the smaller counties that might not have the resources that the larger counties had at hand. You know, we all want to have successful elections, and we want people to have confidence in the elections.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. He's Craig Latimer, president of Florida Supervisors of Elections. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Problems with the 2018 vote in Florida were concentrated in South Florida, especially Broward County, which took a long time to count and then recount votes in close statewide elections, holding up results in a few races. Katie Swatulski covers Broward County for WLRN. Katie, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. A citizens group in Broward County audited the March presidential primary election. What were some of the findings?
Yes, so the group's called Citizens Audit Broward, and volunteers are largely supportive of hand-marked paper ballots. After all of the recounts in 2018, this time the volunteers visited about 140 precincts in March all around Broward County. And they say they could only see posted poll tapes at about 74 of them. So they found some discrepancies, and there's about 11 left that they're still looking into. That's where the numbers can't be balanced with what the Supervisor of Elections office posted. All along in their process, however, they requested public data in different formats from the supervisor's office, and they were concerned by the more technical data side of things.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Part of their concern alleges that the supervisor's office could and should have access to just more data from the machines that are tabulating the votes, right?
Yes. So this particular group, Citizens Audit Broward, they wanted to just sort of sound the alarm bells and raise this flag that they're concerned that the supervisor's offices are limited to using a vendor's software to see data, and that people can't look at data coming from the machines outside of the parameters of that software. so people can't access or query the data for making various types of reports. So the most updated information from the Florida Division of Elections shows a vendor called Election Systems and Software. It's called ES&S, and it makes certified voting systems for 49 counties in Florida. The other 18 counties use a vendor called Dominion. But this extends beyond just Broward County. And so I talked to Perry Busby, a data analyst who used to work for the State Department of Health, who's been looking at the data with Citizens Audit Broward. And he wrote an article detailing his concerns in the Westside Gazette newspaper.
As a part of ES&S's best practices, they allow authorized credential users to access their data through a special software interface. So if you're a user, yeah, you're okay. But that is no guarantee that you're seeing all of the data.
So the Citizens Group is concerned about access to data. What does the supervisor of elections in Broward County have to say about this? Do they also see a shortcoming in access to data?
Peter Antonacci, our Broward supervisor of elections, does not see shortcomings in access to data. And as he puts it, the Citizens Group is just wrong to question this access to data, that it's a misunderstanding of the process to audit machines.
The premise is just wrong. We have access to all data, period. I see a system that runs pretty well as a operational matter, but runs very well, excellently, as a matter of tabulating and reporting. Because those tabulations and those reports are subject to a pre-election audit, open to the public, and a post-election audit, open to the public. And all the information that is in those machines is available for review.
And so when Busby raised the issue on social media, the vendor ES&S responded directly with a statement on Twitter, acknowledging that it does not control a customer database, but that the database and this local access to data is controlled by the elections office and that only these authorized users can log in and access this system. But the vendor did acknowledge that users can only access that system using a secure software. So Busby stands by his findings.
Florida certainly is well known for close elections, really, really tight elections, especially in Broward County, which had difficulty counting and then recounting and then recounting votes in 2018. You covered a lot of that. You covered it from election day through the recounts, Katie. So what assurances are there about the 2020 election count in Broward?
Well, coronavirus kind of throws a wrench into what we've seen before in terms of elections. And Peter Antonacci acknowledges that this election is going to look really, really different because of a huge increase in expected vote by mail ballots. So right now, the supervisor of elections office here, as well as other parts of Florida, they are preparing for this increase in vote-by-mail capacity and their ability to process more vote-by-mail. And in 2018, if you remember, Tom, vote-by-mail processing was one of the major issues.
Yeah, it sure was.
Part of now, going into August, is that we have a new supervisor who has made changes and is looking to beef up the system on all fronts. Part of that's just a push from coronavirus, but part of it is new procedures that were put in place because of the 2018 recounts.
Katie Swatowski covers Broward County for member station WLRN. Thanks, Katie.
Thanks, Tom.
Well, that's our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Denise Royal and Heather Schatz are the producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming. WLRN's Director of Radio Operations is Peter Meritz. We get engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next Friday. Have a safe and happy 4th of July weekend.